there's a purity to magazine making as well, in that it's finite, it's that moment in time, it goes in with mistakes and all. There's no pulling the PDF off the off the bookshelf and you know, all that. And I think that's the beauty of it as well.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. Now, when we bring up change in media habits and consumption, whether in sport or anything else, we're often talking about the new platforms, new devices, new behaviours. But all that change has come for long-established staples as well, not least dear old ink and paper. Pitch Magazine is something of a throwback, a print title for a multi-sport readership, but its ambition is to meet a very particular audience where they are. It was launched in 2022 by Nottingham-based creative agency Stencil and has since evolved into a premium quarterly, with every edition built around a specific theme, serving up feature interviews, slow reads on sports culture, and original artwork and imagery. The latest issue is On the Ashes, released to coincide with England's current tour of Australia, but taking a much longer lens on the rich history of Test cricket's oldest rivalry. Andy Afford is both the managing director of Stencil and the editor of Pitch. He's a former professional cricketer himself with Nottinghamshire, who's gone on to enjoy a fine second career in publishing and creative media. I spoke to Andy about the inspiration for Pitch and the place of print magazines in the digital age. He explained the Pitch strategy for finding and serving readers and subscribers, how its consumer base compares to physical media niches like vinyl, the changing role of the newsstand, and his love of the distinctive process of putting magazines together. And we discussed the editorial direction that Pitch has taken, the decisions that go into an issue with a three-month lifespan, and what to expect from the Ashes special. As a long-time magazine editor myself, I had tons of fun with this chat, and I'm sure you'll find plenty to get your teeth into as well. Once again, usual request, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do subscribe, rate and review on your favourite platform, recommend it to anyone and everyone who might be interested. The social media details are in the show notes if you want to get involved there. Really appreciate you listening, really hope you like this one. Here is Andy Aff. So it's intriguing to me, as a recovering magazine editor, where you are in your print cycle at the moment. So you've just had an issue out, which is, you know, going to form kind of the backbone of this conversation. But at what point do you start thinking about the next one?
It's just ongoing. We try. It's only part of our business in terms of what we do. We do magazines, and as part of that, we do a sport version of Pitch and a music version of Pitch. And then we do a lot of, we're a creative agency based in Nottingham, Stencil. We work it around the system, but broadly, you know, you work that, you're a bright guy. It's every roughly every 3 months. We try to, you know, sometimes it's around the calendar, sometimes it's, you know, so it might be a master's issue, say, if that times, you know, we've got enough lead time to train it, or as this turned out with the Ashes and things like that. Or we've shifted the focus a little bit. This is an all sports title, multi-sports title, but we tried to give them a bit more of a focus. They seem to be easier for readers to get the heads around. So you've got a core subject matter, which is pretty in-depth in 130 pages, and we've got you know, the other things around, you know, we've got a bit of pickleball, a bit of sporting train stations, something a bit on the periphery, and to entertain as well for those pub conversations that that I think magazines are absolutely priceless for enabling blokes to talk about something they know about their mates might not.
Yeah, but you're in the more, I mean, I guess you've got other projects going on, but you're in the more kind of the calmer end of the cycle at this point. You've got a couple of months until
we've
the next
one's
got to...
Yeah, Yeah, we do comps for the Professional Cricketers Association as well. So we've just got a magazine out for them as well. So because I am so old and I've a bit, you know, and I'm a bit of a hands-on on print, I get dragged across to it. But I think everybody likes to decompress for a little bit after getting a magazine out to print. It's that's never changed. You know,
Yeah.
there was a bit of a down, bit of an exhalation, and before anybody's got the gumption to go again, as it
Yeah,
were.
absolutely. What was the inspiration for Pitch Magazine when you guys launched it? Because you're a couple of years in right now, aren't you?
Yeah, no, we are a few years in now. It was never an idea of Kevin Whitchurch, who's the publisher of the magazine. He's if I'm being generous, I'd say a veteran, but he's been around the traps. He was the original editor and publisher of 442 a million years ago, and he's done billions of magazines. So billions is probably an exaggeration, but millions is probably close. And he's always done sport. He thought there was a gap in the market for a sport magazine, and we've ended up, you know, a multi-sport magazine for blokes that he likened it almost a light bulb moment to being sat watching, oddly, watching cricket with his friends, and they would talk about all sports. You know, they've all got a bit of an interest in your key sports. The big five, four, five, maybe football, cricket, rugby, F1, Wimbledon, not tennis, Wimbledon. You know, that sort of common sort of ground, and thought it would make a magazine, especially as a slow read, and in terms of do take it into some sort of depth, tell people a bit about stuff they didn't know about necessarily, and then put them get to read around that sort of stuff by giving them stuff that they do know about and do not.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come on to the kind of the print market in a sec, but the multi-sport element of it is interesting to me because, you know, it was in the sports business media, but it was a multi-sport title that I edited at Sports Pro, and that is a sector where, you know, it is addressed in that way, and you get used to thinking about
Yeah.
sport in that way in some respects too. But when you look at the UK media market, other than the daily newspapers and the broadsheets, like there isn't that much of a space where every sport is addressed with kind of depth
No.
and kind of rigorous analysis. And it's you have football is covered in enormous depth, and there's lots of specialist titles of every different
Yeah.
flavor. And then you have specialists on cricket and rugby and everything else. And obviously, the digital space it's slightly different, but. You know, why do you think that is? Do you think it's purely a resourcing thing, or do you think it's kind of it's because it feels like it was there've been attempts at addressing that, but it's, you know, it's never quite
It's hard
emerged.
to break through. It's hard to break through, definitely. I think we can sort of sustain it because of our business model. We're a creative agency. It's not
Yeah.
publishing is our main business. So we can shoot around the edges of a business model broadly. So sustain it. It's a brilliant training ground. We pride ourselves in attracting young creative talent. And we pride ourselves in developing young creative. So that's a coaching background for myself, and also not being scared of having young people in businesses. And there's a lot to learn about publishing and magazines in particular, what it takes to get them out in terms of product. Everybody thinks they know what the magazines are and how they work and how you make them. And I see that all the time. But the reality of making commercial and commercial looking print titles is a real challenge. There's something about the DNA of people that handle print and use print really, really well. So it's definitely a training slope for our business as well, and a bit of a calling card for our business, because there's such a lot of talent in our magazines in terms of illustrated work and writing and all those sort of things, that we sort of sustain it as a, if it was our business, you know, it would be challenging to sustain it, but we can divvy up X amount of hours per quarter to get magazines out. But within a main publishing business, I think it will be a challenge. The reason it's sort of, as you said, about you've got to tap into something that people love, and we've got to make them love this magazine every bit as much as they love their sport. And if people love their sport or their team or those sort of things, they'll buy anything, or even their band. You know, if you're a Taylor Swift fan or a Guns N' Roses fan or a Beatles fan, you buy stuff with the Beatles on it. Might be a magazine, it might be a mug, it might be a T-shirt, but the thing that brings you to brings the boys to the yard, to paraphrase, I can't remember who had a massive hit with that.
Khalees, yeah.
But to paraphrase, but if you, so our book is the quality of our magazine and the general interest of the music and being part of something different. And we looked at the people that are interested in vinyl, who will spend £10-15 on a slow read, like not dissimilar to, you know, delayed gratification or one of those sort of titles, those reads that sit around and you're proud to have and have on your shelf. You know? So that's how we pitched it, and that's why.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that journey from that nugget of an idea that Kevin had to that point where you're like, this is what the product is actually going to look like. Were there other iterations, other versions of it? Were there, you know, what were some of your reference points when you were putting it together?
I'm not a lifer, but somebody with a good amount of years in magazine making. So you're a newsstand magazine making. So you're constantly looking at what's out there, who's doing it well, who's not doing it so well. You look at a newsstand long enough and you immerse yourself in magazines for long enough. You can even tell within the writing whether a title's got the confidence of some wind behind, they're doing well, or when they're not. You know, it's that sort of, if you're a big fan of honey, you can tell what the bees have been eating type thing, and got to that level of it. So you've sort of soaked in all the influences and you sort of know what good is. And I was very much, you know, music and sport, mainstream magazine making, and mainstream, it's the same as pop, really. It looks easy, but it's incredibly hard to pull off. So you've got all those lessons and things that go into it. So We had enough confidence to sort of make a magazine that we would appeal to us, allied to the talent that we had in the office. When to get it on the newsstand initially, we went to the distributors, and they came up with the multi-image cover idea. That was it. That was to get it on the newsstand. They felt to communicate that. So we went that. That was a concession we made early on. That was a business concession, really. For them to take it, we needed to make that concession. So we did that for several issues. We won an award for art direction for the title that Sam, the creative director, won on behalf of the business. He'd be the first to admit that it was the talented team that pulled that in for us. But fairly recently, we've always had an idea where pitch stories of modern sport, pitch stories of modern music, pitch stories of modern film and TV as a set, and it's the same common themes around it, the same sort of, we thought it was the same sort of person that maybe it would appeal to.
Yeah.
So, you know, the same principles, quality journalism, and interestingly laid out, nice looking magazine that hang around. But we were selling a certain amount, and then we got to decide whether we were going to do a music magazine. And reluctantly, because I was very happily not done the music magazine, because it was it's swearing aloud on your podcast.
It is, yeah.
Because at the time there was a fuck ton of work involved in doing it. I came to the editorial meeting with Kevin and Sam with the idea of saying, no, let's not do it. A title, but we ended up talking about it, and instead of it ended up being a Springsteen issue. But it just all things aligned. It turns off. He was touring. I'm a massive fan, so I thought we could write it. All that. It was 50 years of the Born to Run record, so we ended up bloody doing it, and it sold really well. We sold them all. We sold them all in the UK and America. And that was a single image on the cover, and we looked around what we're going to do. For the first time, we thought, no, bugger it, we'll do it how we want to do it, rather than how we'd ended up doing it. And it just seemed to go well. And then the next the next music, next sport version was a was had a Ferrari focus and a Ferrari cover single image, sold much better than the previous multi image covers. And now we're up to the Ashes issue, which is, it's, you know, it promotes the Ashes as the primary focus of the magazine. That's been the biggest change. To a long answer for a very quick question. But editorially, it's the same sort of principles. We've introduced more illustration over the years as part as a stylistic choice, as a point of difference. And because we have the multi-sports element at all, around the title as well, I think it allows us to, you know, we've got, it's a 130-page magazine. We've got 100 pages of Ashes and 100 pages of Ferrari within the Ferrari title. But there's 30-odd pages of other stuff as well, which gives it a different feel.
Yeah.
And combined with illustration, it enables us to shoot around the edges a little bit and bring the stories around either the Ashes or Ferrari that we found were broadly interesting to broaden sports fans.
Yeah, yeah. What's how's the role of the print magazine change? Because there's, you know, I suppose there's two factors that are shaping the way that Pitch appears and the editorial approach that you take to it. One is that it's a quarterly, which is a different discipline. And, you know,
yeah,
in my time as a magazine editor, I went from 11 issues to 6, and then my successor, Mike Long,
yeah,
went to 4. And you're, it's not just how long is the story going to last, and, you know, having stories in there that are going to last until the next edition, but it's something, it becomes a different product. It becomes a less disposable thing. So you, yeah, want it to live on your desk for longer and things like that.
So that's a primary to make sure that there isn't, that people, when they buy it, they think, oh, that might last me a good amount of time,
yeah,
without it, you know, being so boring you don't get to the end of it.
But then the other part of it is also magazines when, you know, I was a teenager and probably just when I started university, still had that function of, this is the primary place you're going to engage with this culture. And,
yeah,
you know, in much the same way as newspapers might be the primary place you're going to get some of the news, yeah, that you engage with. And obviously that was completely disrupted by the internet. But it feels like magazines now are coming back in a way that's kind of comparable to something like vinyl. Is that a fair comparison?
And how
does that make you think of your audience?
Exactly. That's how we see them. The same person that's going to spend 30 quid on an album now to play on a turntable and blow the dust off the needle. Magazines have always been, certainly particularly men's magazines and sports magazines, have always been luxury purchases, or felt as though they were a luxury, unless you tap into markets like Canal Boat Monthly or Budgerigar Today, where people, they are hills that people die on. You know, they are, I've lost my house, I've lost my car, my wife's left me, my partner's left me, but I'm having Budgerigar Monthly. You know, that's the last stroke, you know. So there is that, but in more general terms, so they are, even at the price of a cup of coffee, broadly, they are still viewed as a luxury property, mm, and a luxury purchase. You can tell that because you never see magazines left on trains.
Mm.
Even, you know, sort of, you used to see miles of newspapers, but you never see magazines.
Yeah, huge bonus pre-smartphone if you found a newspaper on the train.
There you go. But it's that is still the perception. People don't roll them up and stick them. They look after them. They are revered. And they do go on coffee tables. And they do go on people's shelves that have the colours going through. And they do buy back issues they haven't got, and things like that. So we were really, really aware of that. And we tried to lean into that as much as we could. It's definitely a different market. And the model used to be, you know, definitely newsstand first. But it's a really, really difficult model to make work there. This newsstand is a bit about visibility, really.
Mm.
But if you can sell directly and build up an audience, that's how you can create a sustainable print.
Yeah.
And magazine.
How important in the consumer space and a kind of multi-sport space as well that you're in, how important is the newsstand to credibility as well, that you look like a serious title if you're on a newsstand in a way that, I mean, is that, you know, is that a factor at all, or is it just a kind of, it's just a kind of marketing strand for you?
It definitely used to be in terms of selling out. You know, there's a vanity to selling an ad and you'll be on the newsstand, where somebody that's paid for a spot in your magazine when they're at King's Cross would go up, look off and see their ad on the newsstand. But I mean, even ad revenue is really, really difficult to generate, and, you know, against what people might spend online, you know, for return. So it is, you hit the nail, there's a vanity to it. There is a bit of visibility, credibility, definitely. And we do a little bit. The distributors do want some to go on the newsstand. But if I could sell all of our magazines directly and sustain it, I would. A part of me, I do like a few being on the newsstand as well, because that's how you reach, you know, that's, it's another way if somebody might pick you up and become a subscriber, and that's where you try to get them. You're trying to create that habit, and that's why frequency of no fewer really than four a year, you know, you really want that to create that habit and create that expectation where people will get to that end of that cycle and start thinking, oh, I must be doing a magazine. So all those sort of things, that there is a sweet spot for everything in terms of, you know, all the matrix of coordinates that goes into the commercial side of getting a magazine out. They're all they all go into the P brain starts computer mind. We come out a print run we can sustain and a frequency that we can knock out.
Yeah, and how does that print run break down now? What's the kind of proportion that are going and sitting in? I was about to say Smiths, but you know, whatever it's called used to these days,
whatever it's called,
and what proportion goes to subscribers?
Yeah, it used to be sort of infinitely more to Smiths. That used to be the way you reach, but it's reined back significantly now. And if I cut it really close in terms of what that print number is, in terms of our exposure, then I will. So we'll put some hundred on the newsstand. We'll have some hundred go out to subscribers, and we end up with a number in the hopefully in the thousands.
Yeah, and are you targeting? Does that become like a form of advertising campaign almost, that you're kind of targeting? You're thinking, well, where are we going to get foot traffic where people might not necessarily buy a copy, but they'll see a copy and then they'll...
Yeah, we go with travel, really. I think it's that sort of luxury impulse purchase. Somebody getting on a flight or getting on a train, that seems to be, that's where people buy them now. The experience of the high street newsstand is so far down the toilet in terms of what that used to be compared to what it is now, compared to a Waterstones experience in terms of serious print buyers, that, you know, I don't know whether I'd choose to buy a magazine in WH Smiths anymore, but maybe on the run in travel. Yeah.
I think it is Smiths in the airport, and my association with them is paying $4.50 for a bottle of Coke or something.
Isn't positive.
It's positive. But hopefully you're building a positive relationship with your readership, and we do, you know, very handily, A, because of the timing of when this podcast is going out, and B, because of, you know, how it giving us a framework for how one of these magazines comes together. You have your Ashes edition in print now.
Yep, we do.
What, first of all, you know, you're going quarterly and now, as you say, thematic with each issue.
Yeah.
So you're leaning very heavily on a single topic. When you're sitting down with your team, what's the thought process into which topics you're going to cover?
I think it's that balance between entertain and inform, which you're always trying to straddle. You're trying to give certain people that know quite a lot about it something else that they didn't know. And then people that like your general sports fan that likes to be around the big topics at the big times, you give them a good read, a good introduction. And again, you know, sort of think that sense of what they might expect, what it's all about, and what, you know, what's the good and the bad within it. We've done We've done stuff you might expect, which you have to sort of almost tick off, and then we shot around the edges for other sorts of stuff. We got a first person interview with Josh Tung, who I think could be a huge influence in the Ashes, in terms of, it feels like this England coaching team has been building up since taking over the job for this tour in Australia, of tall bowlers that leather it into the pitch. And I mean, if he doesn't, you know, tick the boxes for a tall bowler who leathers it into the pitch, then I don't know. So he's almost the blueprint. And the fact that I find him an interesting, you know, he plays it, not in theory, plays it not as well, which is very dear to my heart. But he's a real impact bowler. He's a bit of a throwback. He's the sort of guy that when he's not bowling, the opposition are looking to think when he might bowl next, because he gets the ball through. You know, sometimes he sprays it a little bit, but he never sprays it slowly. and if he gets it right, he bowls a spell and takes three wickets. And he's got that in the locker. He's a brilliant first ball bowler, in terms of, you come in and if you're not out the traps and ready for him, he's a bit quicker than he looks, and he has that ability to make the ball feel like it's moving back in at you as well, and that hits people on the pads. So he could be a really, really big player in that series. So I thought that was an interesting topic and to do. And then, again, shooting around the edges, I spoke to Graham Swan and Ashley Giles about playing bowling spin in Australia, which I think it's an interesting discipline. And for something else, I spoke to Mike Gatting this week, and he puts the success of his tour in 86, 87, although, you know, Chris Broad, Bill Athey had a brilliant, this is a billion years ago, I appreciate, but he puts the success of that tour down to the control that Edmonds and Embry gave him as a captain, sort of thing, his ability to rotate. And when there was no string left on the ball because the pitches and the wickets were flat, he was able to still maintain control. So I thought it was an interesting angle. So it's those sort of things that I hope we can shoot around, and we can afford to shoot around the edges because of where we sit in the marketplace, where we don't need to have a cover with the two captains on the front and the Ashes urn between them, you know, and it's the flames and the lights, which, if I was putting a mainstream magazine out there and looking to absolutely optimise what we, I'd definitely be doing that, but we don't need to. So we've got a bit of a sideways look at the cover, which is interesting and fun to do. And we've made the magazine feel like that a bit as well.
Yeah. How much have you tried to result proof the, other than the Josh Tung interview, and that could be, you know, hopefully that will be a really significant one to look back on. But for people who are up at 1 a.m. sometime in mid-December and it's all going horribly wrong again.
Well, they're not going to be up at 1 o'clock, I'm telling you that. I mean, that's
the depends, that's the depends on their disposition out. But yeah,
I think you have to be a certain type of harder than hardcore fan to put yourself through the pain of watching Australia beat England in the middle of the night. I think that is not for the faint-hearted. Yeah. And people like that, I think, generally, who don't want to miss it, are going to go along if they can.
Yeah. But in all seriousness, as you say, you've got the luxury of, it's not an Ashes preview, it's an Ashes themed magazine.
Yeah, so you're trying to put the timeless thing that stats around the Ashes as a contest. So you're trying to give it a generalist overview without talking about the specifics of what goes into it. Whereas if you were making a cricket magazine, would be your preview issue. You'd have three magazines probably over that period. Your preview issue, which is timeless and sets up the expectation, you'd have a midway point where you'd lean into something that would be a bigger theme than what's happening in the Ashes. It would be an Andrew Flintoff, Ian Botham, Kevin Peterson, bomb-proof, sort of generally interesting holding issue sort of thing that hits it one way or the other. And then you're in the Ashes roundup, where it's either somebody lifting the urn aloft at Sydney, or it's England cricket goes back to the drawing board and we're revamping county cricket. It's either that or that. Well, I don't think we do in between very well. It's either an absolute triumph or the game's utterly shit. We need to start again. Whereas where the Australians' attitude is completely different, where they just think their particular team at that time was rubbish, and they blame 11 players, where we blame whole systems over in the UK. So that's always interesting.
Yeah, lots of root and branch reviews. Not many trees left after the last decade or so. No, looking elsewhere in the magazine. What I mean, are there any stories that you're particularly proud of beyond the as you say the Josh Tung interview, getting him
the feature interviews are interesting because I've got a pretty good handle on cricket, and Josh is young and at the start of his career, but Graham and Ashley are really good talkers.
Yeah,
you know, Graham, it didn't suit Graham going out to Australia because Graham has got main character energy, and chances are, and I mean that with nothing but love, but you're going out there as a spinner to hold an end up, and that, so he'd never felt the same about going to Australia like he might do going to India or something like that. And Ashley Giles found it all really, really difficult. He gave me a brilliant quote about the intensity being unenjoyable, you know, that's the, which I found a really, really nice way of phrasing it. And that's somebody that, you know, he's just seen a lot, done a lot, and was a bloody grafter. I mean, outside of that, there's lots of the A to Z of the Ashes is interesting. It's brilliantly put together. It's a great looking magazine. We've got a billion infographics in it and the likes, and we've got a brilliant feature writer that writes a lot of our stuff. Our main feature is Paul Simpson, who's written about tons of sport, and that's beautifully illustrated with War Minus the Shooting, it's called, and it takes you through a different kind of A to Z of the greatest innings and greatest hits of the ball. So I defy anybody not to enjoy it. It'll ultimately feel a lot more enjoyable if it could play particularly well as well, which inevitably it does. And again, there's something else. Speaking of Merv Hughes, he said it's it brings out the best and worst of people, in terms of Australia. That intensity is quite, it's quite hard. Even now you can hear the build up, where England are quite cocooned at the moment, but they still, you are getting pelters all the time. So hopefully we've captured a bit of that as well. I wrote a nice thing about, we finish off all our magazines with a baddie, and sometimes they are proper baddies, proper people that in sport that have done properly bad things.
Yeah.
And in this issue, I picked out Douglas Jardine because, he was a pretty dreadful person in his own, without being criminal. But that makes, because that's the spectrum from, the 20s to now, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the Ashes is fascinating in two respects as a kind of vessel for sports stories, because for one thing, and we spoke to Simon Wilde last time about Gilbert Jessop, and you have this lineage of stories going back. I mean, that one is kind of 20, 25 years into the Ashes. It's 125 years ago, and it's capturing a specific place and time. You've got characters like Douglas Jardine and all the rest of it kind of peppered through the history as well. But then you also have, and this is the interesting thing about being a UK-based magazine doing an Ashes special, it would feel very different if it was a UK series, because that's one that, the country would kind of be broadly aware of and following and everything else. Instead, we're kind of trapped in the misery here of our weather and our, short days and everything else that comes with the this part of the year. And in Australia, it's vibrant and active and everything. And, whatever happens, and it has tended to go one ways for each team. Australia don't quite get over the line here, and we very much don't get over the line there. But two very distinct kind of
absolutely. That home advantage it felt completely different when Australia used to beat us here and there. It just felt that they were better than us.
Yeah,
but now
I mean, it's
it does
funny.
Feel a lot more about home advantage or the, you know.
Yeah, I'm of the vintage you grew up with. England getting hammered here as well. And I remember seeing, I think it was Ravi Bapara, but someone a similar age to me in the England team talk about, well, when I was younger, the Ashes didn't seem as big a deal because we just never beat Australia anyway. So the idea that it was this great rivalry felt. Whereas now it's, I feel incredibly tense about the Ashes, but knowing that it's going to be potentially very different results in different countries.
Yeah, we do beat them a bit at home. And going there and winning, I mean, I always think we go with expectation at home. I do. And it never, if you squint at things hard enough, you know, you close your eyes to the narrowest slit, you know, you've got the same number of guys going to do their absolute best as the season of the year before, the years before that, and the years to go after that. So, and the same balance of the side broadly and stuff. And you think, and there's always somebody that might do something, but experience to, and but that's what makes it exciting, that the public can be bothered to get up and think, yeah, no, I think we're going to go and win based on nothing whatsoever. You know, that we beat them once in a blue moon if we're lucky, you know, out there. But I reckon if you went and spoke to English cricket fans about England going to Australia this winter, it wouldn't be any worse than 50-50 in terms of their expectations, whether England would or not, which makes no sense. It's the same way as when England go to World Cups.
Yeah, it's harder to call than it has been for probably since England won last, where I think they were probably slight favourites going into that series. But, you know, it feels like a similar balance. Yeah. But it's...
their batting's a bit worse.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of the... for you as a publisher and someone trying to, you know, collect these stories, you're obviously thinking about it differently for an away series than you are if it was the Ashes as part of an English sporting summer and all the attention and everything that'd be around that.
Yeah, and I think that if England go to Australia and win, it doesn't matter how we win. It doesn't matter. It can be, but for it to really catch light in the UK now, it has to be some special cricket as well to cut through, because we generally win more than we lose now as well. So the result is important, but it's to really, really, for the narrative to take off, it's got to have some special moments in it as well. So I think that's the difference in another difference in home and away, in terms of, because people watch it more because of the timings, they want to be entertained as well. Whereas they'd be very happy to wake up and know that Alastair Cook and Jonathan Trott have batted all night for them and added 200 runs, where you probably wouldn't want to watch it during the day, you know, sort of thing. But it's nice to know that Cookie and Trotty are out there racking the runs up at 2.5 runs and over when you get up in the morning. So yeah. I think that holds true as well.
Yeah, you you're quite modest about it, but you're a former player yourself from what, late 80s, early 90s kind of range.
Yeah. So in 84, I played my first season. I played in a great knock side. I think we could call it a great knock side, and then finished in 97. And then we were a very modest knock side by the end, and I take all full responsibility for that, and none of the credit for the first part. But yeah, so I played 200 first class games. So
yeah. But for someone who's got, you've got a foot in that world and experience of that world, and you've got a foot now in media, and that's been kind of your second career. What's your impression of how the sort of storytelling environment around cricket has changed? Because, you know, that era, you get county cricket on the BBC. Like, it was, you know, the test matches obviously running right through the summer, but you get... it was much more of a part of the mainstream, you know, media, sports media ecosystem in the UK. But at the same time, money-wise and presentation-wise and everything else, it's like a different world in the sort of post-T20 era and, you know, the global profiles of players and stuff like that once they break either into the top echelons of that franchise system or into international teams. So, you know, what... how do you think that's shifted from your seat?
I think how players are measured are different.
Mm-hmm.
For old people like myself, very much test cricket, county cricket, there's a primacy to the long form and the red ball game. And I think the players still really respect that as the most difficult form,
mm-hmm.
in terms of and the most challenging physically and mentally, all those sort of things. I don't think many players would say, no, I think this is more difficult. But that's not necessarily how younger people and players measure success now so much. People want to play cricket for England, I think, to tick a box. But there will be a point now where if they've done it, tick, they're happy to move on, and as they've got a very limited professional career. So professional career and how many people measure what success looks like is maybe winning trophies around the world, or I don't think it's even that. I think it's how successful they are in terms of their ability to command contracts around the world and do and play and be successful in all the formats, really. I can't see that getting shifting back towards Test cricket. And I think it will remain high profile whilst England, Australia and India remain good at it.
Mm.
If there was any dip in India's form, say, I think that the profile of Test cricket might dwindle a little bit out there because everyone's attracted to success.
Yeah.
So if that drops off, then they'd find focus elsewhere. They've got lots of great things happening in India, and lots of great things to be proud of, and lots of their own stuff to get behind. Without the, so they don't need India to be. We need India to be successful more than they do.
Yeah, it's you know, a conversation that has recurred a lot in my career in kind of the business media side of things, with what you do with Test cricket, because there's an obviously very, very captivated audience around it, everywhere, not just, you know, obviously,
yeah,
England, India, Australia is where the money is made, but if you go to talk to fans in the Caribbean, if you go and talk to fans in other parts of South Asia and Africa, they will tell you the same thing, that's the format that, you know, they really love and they really enjoy and kind of get a lot of excitement out of the other ones, but you know, they keep coming back to that, and it's how you make a business model around that has been the challenge, because
yeah,
you know, it works in England when you're selling out stadiums, but
yeah, it's part of the mix. That's all for me. And I think you've got to, you know, I'm talking to somebody that works for a living as well. We all do stuff for cash, you know, and that's, and sport isn't any different to that. So the stuff that you really love, to make room for the stuff that you really, really love, you've got to do this stuff over here as well. And I think that's finding that balance. Whatever we can find a balance, I think we're okay.
Yeah. But the thing that, you know, to come back to the conversation we were having about magazines and vinyl, you know, it feels like sport is both the easiest place to serve niche audiences, but the hardest place to build niche products, because you can make a limited magazine run and you can make that work, but because you're working with talent, you can't make Test cricket too niche because the players won't want to play in it, and then it won't be the same thing anymore.
It works exactly that. So it's, I don't think we've got it far wrong in the UK. I pity some of the other, it seems a crying shame, some other countries that struggle to sustain their talent pool. But again, some businesses struggle. Mm. You know, they struggle through and they keep going, and that's just the way it is. And England have got as good a chance of developing good players because we've got a pretty good system that pays athletes pretty well to choose cricket, not as well as football, not as well as some of the other single sport, you know, sort of things like that. But it's a career that you can make, you know, you could be a millionaire being a sport, as being a cricketer. So there is that pathway where there is that available elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not so easy. So we have got that pathway and that ability to do that, and that's not our fault. really. You know, that's just a billion-year-old system that's left us with what we have. And you know, the successful sale of the 100, in terms of that, our ability to commercialize and commoditize cricket in that form that 20,000 people want to go and watch it on a Sunday night or Sunday afternoon at Trent Bridge, men and women.
Yeah.
You don't need to love that to know how important it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's just bring it back to the magazine for a bit before we wrap up. I mean, we've talked about what makes the Ashes compelling, both to cricket fans and, you know, as a component of sort of the lore and heritage of cricket. But when you're thinking about these theme issues, you talked about Ferrari, as opposed to doing a Formula One issue, you did a Ferrari issue. You know, when you're looking across 2026, what makes for a compelling idea for one of these quarterly editions in print?
You've got to find something that you can have an idea, but you've got to be able to find a way of reaching them as well. So that's why we picked Ferrari as the first thing, because people that care about Ferrari really care about Ferrari. And in the same way that our first music title about Springsteen, there's people that like Springsteen, but people love him. You know, sort of they really love him and buy everything. I'm a massive Springsteen fan. It's an absolute curse to see another Springsteen magazine on the newsstand because there might be something in it. I don't know. So you're back at the well, aren't you? Sort of thing like that. You buy it because you care so much. In the same way that you go and see him, you buy a T-shirt, and in my case, you take your family as well. It's that sort of thing. So you've got to find those sort of things, those touch points that people really, really, really care about, and as much as anything, are happy to spend money on. You know, you've got to get them to commit to spending money. So it's not just that they're interested and excited about it, and are they prepared to commit 10 or 15 quid to it?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of big ideas, and we go through no end, you know, in terms of what we think. But you've got to be able to identify it up by an audience that you think you can sell a magazine to on their passion and deliver.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So, I mean, looking into 2026 without giving away anything you've not committed to, I mean, there's a Winter Olympics and there's a World Cup, and in both cases, audiences and kind of, you know, resonant elements of those cultures are not hard to find. But, I mean, is that the approach, or will you kind of be a bit more lateral about it? How are you?
We'll try to. I mean, ideally, what you don't want to do is to be just based around the cycle, the calendar, as much as you can, or you end up with Wimbledon every year. You know, sort of thing. You land there. So, and also, you've got to have the ability to surprise people as well, your subscribers, when you've got them. So they can't guess what it might be. You know, chances are we'll do a World Cup football edition because England are going to go, as we said about the Ashes, England are going to go and win the World Cup. So that's where we are in that sort of thing. So, and they will be flying and travelling, so we can find them at the newsstand, and we can do this.
Yeah,
and we can find England fans group. So all those sort of things, and then the other stuff, it might be if we think that there is instead of a Wimbledon issue, there's an audience for the Williams sisters. We think we can reach them. We can write a credible and compelling magazine that supports them and get some level of access to shoot around the edges as well. We might do that. But, you know, I'm talking to somebody immersed in editorial. This is the fun of being in editorial meetings. It's kicking ideas around, and they're all good ideas. They're all good ideas that you have to run through that matrix again of, you know, of can we do it? Is it doable? Is it timely? Can we sell it? You know, that's that sort of thing. So we'll be exactly the same filters on all these subsequent titles.
Yeah. What are your ambitions now for Pitch? Not just, I guess, the sport version, but your little stable of Pitch magazines there.
I think we've won one BSME award, which I couldn't be any more proud of. We've since refocused the magazine, and I think we're doing something genuinely interesting with our music titles in the bookazine one shot field, where it tends to be those sort of things will be, say, because I've mentioned them already, a Guns N' Roses issue, and it'll all be aggregated old stuff that comes in. All you need to know about that. Whereas ours, it's all new, but artist-led and things like that. So, and it did incredibly well for us by our standards, by most standards, sort of thing like that. So I think that's really interesting. So I think our music titles, in the context of how publishing groups do music magazines, I think what we're doing is really interesting in that space.
Yeah. Okay. And what are you enjoying most about being in this world at the minute?
In this world generally, or
in the magazine world?
In the magazine world, I get a kick out. So we've got an incredibly young team. I've mentioned it before. An incredibly young team here, and I get a kick in seeing. We've got an illustrated cover on here that I'd never do with it. But the artwork is absolutely beautiful, and I get a kick out of that going in, because that's quality. We all know the hours that it takes to generate things like that. And I get a kick out seeing young people doing something creative and love doing it. And it's magazines, which is old blokes territory, and they still get a kick out. Obviously, the first thing they do when they see their work in it, they take a photo of it. So it goes from being real, and they love that, and they take a photo, which makes me laugh and isn't lost on me either. But so I think that's the most pleasurable, and the opportunity for people to learn about there's a purity to magazine making as well, in that it's finite. It's that moment in time. It goes in with mistakes and all. There's no pulling the PDF off the bookshelf and you know, all that. So, and I think that's the beauty of it as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that you have to commit a good amount of money to publishing one, you know, all those sort of things. It's a privilege to be in that sort of position and be able to take that helicopter view of it and see what people making the magazine gets out of it, as well as people reading the magazine. So I think that's probably what's in it for me.
Yeah, that's lovely. I remember that impulse of seeing your name in print. It is just a different register, I think. But the other thing, as you say, it's the finite space that you're working with, and it's a special kind of creativity and collaboration when you know, you're each feeding into what goes into that space when it's not infinite. Lots of fun talking about that and all the rest of it. And I will enjoy taking a look at the Ashes issue. There's three questions that we ask every guest before we let them go. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport? And obviously you're a former professional, but you know, where did it start before that?
Very proud to say I'm brought up by my mum, and I remember her throwing tennis balls for me to catch, and playing a game called one knee. Whereas if you dropped a catch, you went down on one knee. If you dropped another catch, you went down on two knees. And I remember that. And you know, my mum would have said at the time, and I remember her saying at the time, you know, we haven't got a lot of money, but you'll have my time. So things like that is still an incredible memory for me in terms of what got me playing sport, and her love for me and confidence in me to make me think that a boy from out in the boonies of Lincolnshire could play professional sport for a living. So that's, I suppose, that moment. I still remember it now, that catching the ball on the ball moment. She couldn't catch the bloody thing now, I'm sure. But she could then, and she's still with us. That's it.
Yeah, that's a lovely story. What's your favourite piece of sports storytelling?
In terms of in it having everything, I think Botham's Ashes of 81 takes a bit of beating, doesn't it? I mean, that's, you know, I've loved other stories around. You know, there are brilliant. That's why we like sport, because it gives us that. But he was England captain, then he wasn't. And then, so he resigned from that. He couldn't be doing any worse. His dad came back to the team. Mike Brearley, you know, that fatherly figure. And he beat Australia on his own after that. I mean, you know, that's more Bollywood than Bollywood, sort of thing like that. So I still think, and anything I've ever done with Ian Botham's always been certainly the highlight of my journalistic career for my mom, that's for sure. So you don't get to that the status of Sir Ian by accident, do you?
Yeah. What's your favourite rendering of that? There was a documentary. In terms of how people have... Yeah, how people live
it. Yeah. It's coming across it, really. It's the fact that it was archived, and it was across the TV, and there's a billion stuff in the retelling of it all the time. But yeah. I just think it's how it holds a place in my memory is something that's aspirational. Like I said, for every Ashes series, you expect a Botham's Ashes or a 2005 or a Ben Stokes win at Headingley. That's what that Ashes narrative gives us, and the cherry on the top of that was that. In terms of storytelling, you know, and sports books, if we're looking for things like that, I loved Simon Hughes's first book, A Lot of Hard Yakker. I thought that was a brilliantly written book. Don't tell him.
That's his second recommendation in 2 weeks. So he's...
Oh, is that right? Yeah, I think I thought it was really inspiring. And outside of that, Gary Nelson's book, I think it might have been Left Foot Forward or Best Foot Forward. And Gary Nelson was a journeyman footballer writing about what he thought would be his last career in football. And yeah, it's truly brilliant.
Yeah. Again, Simon Wilde, who included A Lot of Hard Yakker. And he talked about that perspective. And Conan Ireland, who we've had on the podcast as well, sharing that perspective from the world of tennis, of the journeyman, slightly dismissive way of framing it maybe, but like the more sort of
the supporting cast
of professional sport, kind of having a slightly different perspective and maybe a more rounded perspective on that world than someone at the absolute elite, you know.
I mean, that was Simon at his most humble, in the nicest possible way, and he's a colourful and interesting guy and tons of fun and all that, but that was his book. You know, that was his book. If you say everybody's got a book in, then blimey, that was his book. Yeah. There was every word on that page felt truthful.
Yeah. What's a sports story you'd like to tell or see somebody else tell?
A few years ago now, I'd consider myself good friends with a guy called David Hepworth, who's a music journalist, was one of the live anchors for Live Aid. So he's done everything in music. And I get on well with him, and I remember telling him a story about bowling at Viv Richards. And he had a thing on in a chintzy pub in Islington, that side, called True Stories Told Live, where you go on and you speak for, I can't remember, it's an X amount of minutes without notes, and you have to tell a story. So I told, in terms of my own storytelling, telling Viv Richards to, all I could think to say at the end of the story, I told him to fuck off. and I was a very young cricketer at that stage. There's a whole series that gets to the point where I tell him to fuck off. And it did work out incredibly positively in my favour. And seeing,
what a surprise. And
getting back to the dressing room, and nobody would look at me. And then in the bar afterwards, obviously the first fucking person I see in the bar is Viv. And I think this is going to be ugly. And he walked across to me and asked me if he could buy him a drink.
Yeah, fantastic.
So, because he's a beautiful, classy guy.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You just got to find the right context, the right way of doing that one. I quite like spoken word version, one man show with Andy Afford. Andy,
I've got one good story over that too.
Andy, it's been a real pleasure, and everyone look out for Pitch Magazine next time you get in a plane or a train, but you can subscribe as well. Thanks very much. Outlines is an original production from 2640.